All right, I'm going to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee meeting to order for Monday, March 6, 2017. And please remember, turn your cell phones off or down, or you can bring us some bagels or donuts. And let's see, members present, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Vice Chair Wool, Representative Knopp, Representative Josephson, and we're being joined by Representative Birch and myself, Chair Keto. We do have a couple of items on the calendar. We do have, had noticed, House Bill 132 and Senate Bill 14, Transportation Network Companies, that were pending referral, and they are no longer on the agenda. We're going to have to postpone those to a future meeting. So the bills we have before us today are House Bill 141, Alaska Workforce Investment Boards, and then House Bill 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation. And we will be hearing both of the bills, not moving them. We have left public testimony open on House Bill 79. I am going to close public testimony now, but we will reopen it after we have some additional information on the bill presented to the committee. So I will close public testimony on House Bill 79 now. And I will bring, let's see, I guess we were going to do House Bill 141 first, so that closes public testimony on 79. That's taken care of. We don't have to worry about that when it comes up. House Bill 141, let's see, do we have Representative Fansler? Can you come forward? Put your name and affiliation on the record. Now bring your staff forward if you want as well, Mary, and give us a presentation on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Representative Zach Fansler, representing District 38, Bethel, the lower Kuskokwim, and parts of the lower Yukon. Today I am here to speak about House Bill 141, which is entitled An Act Relating to Allocations of Funding for the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Alaska Statute 23.15.820 authorizes the Alaska Workforce Investment Board to administer the Alaska Technical and Vocational Education Program, hereinafter going to be referred to as TVEP. This legislation reauthorizes the allocation of the TVEP funding for 5 years. TVEP was established by legislature in 2000 with the purpose of enhancing the quality and accessibility of job training across the state and aligning training with regional workforce demands. TVEP funds are obtained from a portion of employee contributions to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. The TVEP funds are allocated to technical and vocational education entities across Alaska designated by AS 23.15.835. Each entity receives a set percentage of the TVEP funds available each fiscal year. The current allocation sunsets June 30, 2017. Unless the allocation is reauthorized, this funding will sit unused in the TVEP account instead of being used by these entities to train Alaskans. TVEP recipients are required by statute to track and report program outcomes to the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. Each year, the board compiles and provides to the legislature a TVEP performance report containing this information. In fiscal year 2016, the 10 TVEP recipients were allocated $12,510,900 and served 10,295 youth and adults. A statewide network of training providers is critical to developing an Alaska workforce. This legislation is necessary to help educate and train Alaskans for Alaska's jobs. And if I can, maybe just go over and hit the programs that are going to be impacted by this. The University of Alaska statewide receives 45% of the TVEP funds. The Galena Interior Learning Academy, based in Galena, it receives 4% of the TVEP funds. The Alaska Technical Center, located in Kotzebue, receives 9% of TVEP funds. The Alaska Vocational Tech Center, AVTEC as it is, in Seward, received 17% of TVEP funds. The Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center, NACTEC, based in Nome, receives 3% of TVEP funds. The Southwest Alaska Vocational and Education Center, Savak, based in King Salmon, receives 3% of the TVAP funds. Ute Illinois Incorporated, the People's Learning Center, based in Bethel, receives 9% of TVAP funds. Partners for Progress in Delta Incorporated, located in Delta Junction, receives 3% of TVAP funds. The Amundsen Educational Center, located in Soldotna, receives 2% of TVAP funds. And Ilisavik College, located in Utgavik, receives 5% of the TVAP funds. This is a straight-up authorization bill. It is reauthorizing this for 5 years rather than 3 years, so it would these distributions would be set in place until June 30th, 2022. This is a bill that is very important to many of our communities around the state and very, very important to our resource development systems. This is making sure that Alaskans are trained up so that they can perform the jobs and get the work in their regions. That is why we are in full support of House Bill 141. I can now take any questions or refer to any comments that the board, that the committee may have.
Thank you, Representative Fansler. And a question from Representative Birch.
Where does the money come from that that pays for this through the chair?
And through the chair, Representative Birch, this is funded by a portion of the employee contributions to the unemployment insurance that is paid, that every Alaskan will pay. And it is distributed to technical and vocational education entities across Alaska's regions in accordance with the statute 2315-835.
I guess if I might, as a follow-up, how is this going to benefit individual constituents of mine? They're going to have these dollars taken out of their wages to presumably train people to either replace them or I mean I'm just trying to understand the linkage there between, you know, what's the benefit to somebody having this peeled out of their paycheck on an hourly basis going forward?
Well, there's already going to be the unemployment that's being pulled out for the unemployment reasons. What the benefit here is to make sure that a worker that perhaps was not qualified for a well-paying job, which is the intent of these, and you know, we'll use an example of perhaps someone that was formerly not qualified to, say, work on the North Slope or somewhere like that. Can now, this money would go to get that person trained up so that they can go and they can work for that. It's based regionally, so it very much targets the industries of each region. So, for instance, in the Bethel region, which I'm familiar with, Illinois does a lot of training for CDLs and things like that. So although the idea may be that it's one way to look at it is perhaps the way you said it, but perhaps a better way to look at it is this is an opportunity for upward mobility for employees to get better jobs, for us to have our high-paying jobs stay within the state and keep that money based here in our economy.
If I might, it appears to me like it comes out of the hide of the working person. Basically, you're shaving something out of their paycheck every day, you know, all year long, to go into a fund that provides training for somebody that you know, may be interested in replacing them down the road, or what. I guess I'm not convinced that this is a good thing. You know, I mean, I'm just looking at the, you know, it's a big pot of money. It's a fair amount of money, but you know, anytime you start taking money out of an individual worker's paycheck, I think we have a very high bar, a very high standard, and a very high hurdle here to ask ourselves: is this a reasonable thing? Do we really want to take these dollars out of the working person's paycheck? And that's why we're here today. But I'm challenged to understand where it's of value to the person that's actually working. And seeing their paycheck diminished by whatever incremental amount that might be. Thank you.
Through the chair, if I may respond, one of the things that I think is incredibly valuable about this program and about these types of vocational programs is that we have a wide distribution of jobs around this state. And we have some that are in the service industries. We have some high-class jobs that, might be, you know, you need a professional degree for in the healthcare fields, attorney work, things like that. This is a program that is designed specifically at jobs that are going to utilize our resource development industries. It's designed specifically to get our folks the skills that they need so that they can contribute and that they can get jobs and bring the money back to their region. The funding mechanisms for this have been set in place now for many years. But ideally, I think what we all want as Alaskans is to some point get to a place where workers can, you know, be able to get that upward mobility and be able to say, hey, I no longer necessarily qualify for a job that might be, on just the bare minimum wage job. This is an opportunity for that worker to get that mobility, to move upward and get a job that's going to be paying them a respectable living fee that they can bring back to their community. They can keep that money here in Alaska. And eventually what's going to happen is this is going to help our overall economy. We see millions of dollars that leave this state every year going to folks that are not living in Alaska. They're coming up here, they're working two on, and then they're flying down to live their two off in other parts. That's money that's being taken directly out of our economy. That's money that's directly impacting our Alaskans, and we want those jobs to be going to folks that are going to, if they are taking a two on, two off, they're going to return to your region. They're going to come back, and they're going to put that money back into the economy locally. So the goal is always to train Alaskans to do Alaskans jobs.
Again, I think Representative Birch, I think we've got some other questions, and then get back to you, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking through this paperwork, and I don't see the funds for this program come out of the unemployment that is paid. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So I'm presuming that if this program is not continued, if it's allowed to sunset, that unemployment insurance is not going to go down. People are not going to see that reflected in their checks.
Representative Stutes, you're 100% correct. Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for pointing that out. This is not going to be a means that will put money back in the pockets of currently working Alaskans. This is money that's simply designated from that unemployment removal to make sure that we can get as many Alaskans back to work as possible.
Thank you, Representative Ansar.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You listed where the communities were of all these learning centers, but Alaska Technical Center, maybe I missed that one. Where's that one located?
That's in Kotzebue.
Kotzebue.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Thansler, two questions. First is, do other states also make this sort of investment with their UI benefits? And the second question, and it'll come to me, is what percent of the total UI pie is this?
This is, through the chair, regarding your first question, Representative Josephson, that's not something I have at my fingertips right now, but I'd certainly be happy to compile a list of other states that do this. It's our understanding that it does happen, somewhat frequently throughout the United States. So this is a pretty common occurrence. We can give you the statistics on those and gladly bring them back for our next presentation. For the obtained funds that are coming out of the employee unemployment insurance, it looks like we're at 16% here of the, I'm sorry, 0.16 of the employee unemployment insurance contribution. So it is
16%. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd be more comfortable. Is this elective on the part of the employee since you're taking money out of their pocket? I mean, obviously, people, if they want to have a, you know, choose to have a benefit, then they can opt to. But it's my understanding that this is basically just layered into, you know, what they perceive to be unemployment insurance. But in fact, it's a you're peeling off a fair amount, like $5 million, I guess. I mean, it seems like it's a fair amount of money that you're taking out of working people's. And these are people that are already working. I mean, it's not a matter of, somebody going out and saying, hey, I want to, I want to invest I want to learn how to weld, and they go, go and take that personal initiative. This seems like you're taking money out of people that are already working. You're taking it out of their paychecks in order to basically fund training courses all over the state, apparently.
Through the chair, if I may, Representative Birch, there's a good chance that those working Alaskans have already passed through these programs, and that's part of the way they probably have gotten into the positions they've been in, by attending the different programs that are being benefited from this. So, to be fair, alternative way to phrase what you're saying is possibly this is them paying back into the system that's already benefited them, allowing them to get the training at a reasonable price at somewhere that's located reasonably close to their community, so that they can become a very important part of our fiscal climate. So.
But they do not have a choice in that matter, though, right?
And Representative Birch, I guess, I think one of the things that Representative Fansler is trying to indicate is that this amount of money, or this money, is being paid for by the employees, regardless of whether the TVET program is happening or not. And the TVET program provides opportunities for retraining individuals as they maybe need to look at changing career paths. And not having that opportunity, I think, is going to be a challenge for Alaska, especially when we see a contraction in the economy where people might need to be retrained. So we could let the program go away, but then we're not going to have opportunities for individuals in Alaska that could get the training that could get them into productive careers in the future. So I do think that the idea is really keep the program going so we can keep some training available for people that might need to change careers.
And if you will, it's paid for then out of the unemployment insurance
correct
tax or whatever on the okay. Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on your point, through the chair to the representative, so the issue that Mr. Birch is talking about, and to the chairman's point, this bill does nothing. That's all in a separate statute. All this bill is doing is extending the deadline by 5 years and allocating the percentages of the dollars already collected. So really what we're talking about here is a completely separate issue, not in relation to this bill. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, I would be hesitant to say the bill does nothing, but I would say
in regards to the issue that we're
in regards to how much is taken out of unemployment compensation, yes, you are correct. It does not speak to that necessarily. This is merely, as you said, a using of those funds that are being taken out already and putting them towards vocational and technical education programs.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Fansler, just wanted to check to see how much is actually collected through the unemployment insurance tax on a yearly basis.
Representative Sullivan-Leonard, that is an excellent question.
And Representative Sullivan-Leonard, we do have representatives from the Department of Labor here and available for questions, so maybe we can cut Representative Fansler loose unless we've got questions specifically for him regarding the program.
You bet.
Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was along the same lines, because it was stated that these monies, I think it's around $4 million, represents 0.016% of all UI contributions. And maybe I'm getting
point one through the chair, Representative Wohl, Vice Chair Wohl. Point 16, I believe, not .016. And
so 16%.
Well, maybe she just maybe.
So we should wait Representative Mansler, I think if we can bring
we can get a clarification.
Paloma Harbor with a department up, or who is going to come up for the department,
right.
Commissioner Dragas. Ms. Harbor? So we will have representatives from the department come up and answer some of those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And with me is Paloma Harbor, who is our Administrative Services Director.
Thank you. Regarding Representative Sullivan Leonard, do you want to restate your question?
Do you want me to redirect? Okay. Thank you, through the chair. My question was with regard to funding with the unemployment insurance that is captured every year. What do you have for an average then? Because that's been from year 2000 to present 2016 findings.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. What are you asking?
How much have you collected? How much has the state collected on a yearly basis then from its inception? This started in year 2000, and you've collected unemployment insurance dollars towards this fund all the way up to 2016?
So I'm
just trying to check to see how much is collected.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I don't have a rolling total from since 2000 that goes into this fund specifically. The amount available for distribution that we're projecting to be available for distribution in fiscal year 2018 is almost $12 million in this fund. That's up over the, well, it's down from FY17, but it's been around $12 million for the last 3 years.
I'm sorry, how much? Through the chair.
$12
million. $12 million per year.
Mm-hmm. And that, as clarification, that's the entire collection for unemployment insurance, or is that the available amount for TVEP?
That's the available amount for TVEP.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And Representative Birch.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So $12 million a year, how much flexibility do we have, we being the legislature, in assigning these dollars to, say, the Hutchinson Career Center in Fairbanks or the Martin Luther King Career Center in Anchorage? I mean, there's all sorts of tremendous needs out there, but I, you know, if we're going to redirect these to, you know, kind of training up, you will, if you will, you know, folks into the labor market, it just seems like you know, $12 million a year would be a huge bump in the education arena, and I just don't know how much flexibility you have in using the unemployment insurance for that purpose.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, the entities that receive this funding are designated in statute, so it is up to the legislature who receives the funding and at what percentages. So it would be through this legislation or similar legislation that you would say, we want to give this much to this entity. The bill that's before you is a straight reauthorization of the current distribution for 5 more years.
Okay, if I might follow up then. So $12 million a year, and what percentage of the overall unemployment insurance, to my colleague from the Matt Sue, what percentage is that of the total? Is it the 0.16 that we were talking about?
So the 0.16, through the chair, Representative Birch, is 0.16% of the employee's taxable wage base, or UI taxable wage base. So that's like close to $40,000 for each employee. I think it's $39,500 or something like that. I don't have it in front of me. So on that $40,000, it's a 0.16%. And so that's how much goes into this fund for each employee that's out there. Overall, their UI employment contributions varies depending on the year, but it's about 0.5% of that taxable wage base, and we're only taking 0.16 and putting it into this account.
So 0.16 goes into 0.5 about three times, so it's like 30%, is that right?
That would make sense.
So 30% of the unemployment insurance is being redirected to these TVAPs?
No, 30% of the employee's contribution. The employer pays another 70, well, not 70%. Yeah, 0.7% or 0.73 okay. or.
So fully one-third of the employee's contribution, again, through the chair, fully one-third of the employee's contribution to unemployment insurance is being directed by the legislature to these TVAP programs. I guess, is there any constraints on that? Could you make it half, or I'm kind of challenged with it. It's unemployment insurance, but we're pushing it to education. So I'm just wondering, is there any limit on that? Can you bump it up to half, or is there, I'm just asking the question because I'm not familiar with the program.
Again, through the chair, Representative Birch, yes, you can go up to their full employee contribution. Of course, what that does, if you divert more of the employee's contribution, then you would impact the employer's contribution. So there's a formula that says this is much, how much has to be collected to support unemployment insurance. So if you decide to divert more of the employee's contribution to training programs, then the employer will have to fund more of that total contribution that's needed to fund unemployment insurance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, in part, but I'm still struggling with the, presumably the unemployment insurance is supposed to be there when you're unemployed, that you've got a check coming in. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like if you're using a third of it to pay for an education program for people that are working and already employed, it seems like it's not going for the purpose that it was originally intended.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, we can get you that percentage of what it is in the overall UI. I think that's sort of what you're getting at. I think the point of this TVIP legislation is that it has been working since 2000. I think the adage, a rising tide lifts all boats, really kind of encapsulates what the TVIP program is about. And when you have to remember, UI is unemployment insurance. It's an insurance program. So it kicks in when someone is out of work. So the TVET program falls squarely within the ambit of unemployment insurance. The idea is that collectively people have a portion of their unemployment insurance siphoned off to help all Alaskans go back to work. And we have regional training centers, the university, AvTech. We have 11 different recipients across the state. Sorry, 10. Please don't add in the that's up to the legislature. We have 10 different recipients that are across the state that use this money to train Alaskans for jobs. It's squarely within unemployment insurance. That's why it was created 17 years ago. It's been extremely successful. We have several different recipients of TVEP that are on the line that would be happy to speak to it, others that would be happy to speak to it in future opportunities for public testimony. So I just wanted to make sure that went on the record. It is a highly successful program, and the department stands behind it 100%.
Okay, by way of follow-up, I buy a lot of insurance. I buy car insurance, I buy health insurance, I buy house insurance, and I buy life insurance. But they're all insurances that I pay for, and they basically, at the end of the day, they benefit me or my beneficiaries. And it seems to me like we're taking unemployment insurance that good, hardworking people are putting in and taking one-third of their contribution to their unemployment insurance and going out and training people that are not them. In other words, they're not the beneficiary. You know, it's altruistic, maybe it's great, but it's not, it doesn't fill what I would see a role as insurance. Which it'd be, insurance typically would be for my benefit. If I'm paying unemployment insurance, I can see I become unemployed. I get a check. But when you siphon off, to use your word, a third of it to go to supporting colleges and learning academies all over the state, it seems to me like it kind of begs the question. And we do have to, $12 million is not an insignificant amount of money. And we're appealing, we're doing amendments for a thousand here and a thousand there. So,
I guess I'm just challenged by the purpose, and it's new to me, but I'm not comfortable with the using unemployment insurance for this purpose.
So, Representative Birch, I would like to move on, but I would say that I pay every year for my auto insurance. I don't receive a benefit from that auto insurance unless I have an accident, so I can pay for many years and not receive a benefit of that insurance. So we pay to try and benefit the program overall, and the program provides for education and retraining for individuals that might have lost their job, which is why they're paying into unemployment insurance in the first place. But I would actually like to try and get to some of the other invited testifiers, so we can bring the department back up for additional questions, but I do have people online that I'd like to try and get to. So we do have Fred Villa from the university. So Mr. Villa, can you put your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. My name is Fred Villa. I'm Associate Vice President with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee. And I'd also like to thank Representative Fansler for sponsoring this bill. The University of Alaska is very supportive of this reauthorization. We utilize this funding to really respond to the needs of to the state of Alaska in outreach, academic, and certification programs, and also professional development. It's critical to provide the size, scope, and quality, but particularly the access to programs throughout the state, to regional training centers and the University of Alaska as well. The University of Alaska has some specific areas that we work in, focusing on career pathways for individuals leading up to jobs, but also look at the opportunities for economic development and high-demand jobs in areas throughout the state. We work specifically based on the priorities established by the Workforce Investment Board in priority industries and occupations. So this is a critical, important program for the university as we look at addressing issues across the state. And in our packet within the documents that you do have available to you, you can see a number of the milestones or significant contributions that TVEP has made across the university system, including most specifically in the health arena, which is the largest growing industry sector in the state. We have had a major impact in all health-related fields, in doubling the number of engineers, starting regional training centers, and providing opportunities at times for students who can get dual credit in technical programs, so they're getting credit both for high school and for college credit as they're leading up to those things once they graduate from high school. I'm open to any questions that you may have about TVEP, how the university manages our contributions, and I thank you for the opportunity, Chiquito.
Thank you, Mr. Villa. And do we have any questions for Mr. Villa from the members of the committee? Our next invited testifier is Pearl Brower with Ilisavik. Ms. Brower, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony.
Wonderful. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Oh, great. Ula Lutuk, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Pearl Brower, and I serve as president of Ilisavik College, Alaska's only tribal college and only independent community college. In the fall of 2016, Ilisavik was rated the number two community college in the nation and Alaska's number one community college. We're a public institution accredited by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities. Today, I'm testifying in support of the reauthorization of the Technical and Vocational Education Program, House Bill 141. We advocate for the status quo reauthorization of this very important legislation. Ilisavik joins 9 other organizations as a part of this program, all who have a mission of providing quality workforce development, designed education to support the needs of our Alaskan residents. Ilisavik receives 5% of the allocated TVEP funding. With these funds in FY16, we served over 700 adult and high school students, and that's an unduplicated count. Of the 10 organizations who participate in TVEP, Ilisavik ranks the highest in the 2016 performance measures. 82.7% of our TVEP-funded students were employed, 1 year after exit, and the median wage of these individuals was over $24,000 7 to 12 months after exit. Through the funding, Ilya Sokolovich is able to offer a number of training opportunities across our state, providing residents the ability to be credentialed to get jobs or to advance in their current jobs. And due to a lot of certifications, many of our employed residents across our state actually have to get certified every year or every few years. So they pay into the unemployment insurance and then are able to get recertified through some of these funds. Without TVEP funding or with a TVEP restructure, we would not be able to reach as many Alaskans nor provide as many workforce development training opportunities as we do today. As we look to the future, I believe we all know that education must be a priority for all of us Alaskans. We must continue to support programs that provide opportunity for the future of our state. At Ilya Sokolovich, we say more education, more options, more out of life. Today, that not only rings true for our students, but for all of our Alaskan residents. Please join me in supporting the reauthorization of TVEP status quo as presented in HB 141. Clean up, Buck.
Thank you, Dr. Brower. Do we have any questions from members of the committee for Dr. Brower? Seeing no questions, we have one more person that identified as invited testimony. So, Dennis Deshaun with you at Illivard. Elit Nuvarvet, I think you're going to have to help me with that one. Dennis, Dennis, if you can put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members. My name is Dennis Deshaun. I'm the Executive Director for Youth Elit Nuvarvet in Bethel, Alaska, translated to the People's Learning Center. What we do in Bethel at Youth Elit Nuvarvet is educate local people for family wage jobs locally. We have various programs that utilize the TVEP funding, not only for new training that gives people jobs, but also for incumbent worker training. We have several programs that we operate on an as-needed basis. All of our programs are structured to where people go to work at the completion of their program. In FY16, we serviced 724 individual students with 1,082 services given. Some of our programs include various National Center for Construction and Education Research certifications. We do adult basic education and GED training. We do dental assistant and dental health aid therapy training. We do certified nursing training. We run the federal apprenticeship program for plumbers and electricians in our region. We have a driver's license and a CDL program, which almost everybody gets jobs with when they're done with that. And then we have various different on-demand trainings that lead directly to jobs. TVEP is very important to us to maintain our structure and the ability to train local people close to their home for high-paying jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Deshaun. Any questions from the committee members for Mr. Deshaun? That completes our invited testimony. What I'd like to do now is go ahead and open up public testimony at 3:54. Public testimony is open on House Bill 141, and I do have people signed up to testify. Go to the off-net first, Joel Aloha with Manilik. Mr. Aloha, can you put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for allowing me to testify today, and thank you, Representative Fansworth, for sponsoring this bill. My name is Joel Aloha. I'm the Community Health Services Director for Manilik Association, a regional nonprofit that provides medical, social, and tribal services for the 8,500 residents of the Northwest Arctic Borough in the community of Point Hope. The Manilik Association has an important vital working relationship with the Alaska Technical Center, or ATC, in Kaskaskia. ATC provides trainers and training facilities for our regional medical providers, water sanitation, and infrastructure technicians. Many of our staff members need continual training to either attain new positions or retain current positions within the Manilik Association. As you know, the medical and health environment services field is continually changing with new practices and technology being introduced. Our partnership with ATC enables our staff to be trained to be providing the best medical and health environment services possible for all of our regional and state residents. On behalf of the Humane Association Community Health Program, we are supportive of this bill and urge the Alaska Legislature to reauthorize House Bill 141 to fund technical training for Alaskan residents and workers in Northwest Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Aloha. Any questions for Mr. Aloha from the committee? Not looking like it. So we have next Anisha Elby from King Salmon. Can you please place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Keto and representatives. My name is Anisha Elby. I'm here with Annette Caruso. We're co-executive directors of Southwest Alaska Vocational Education Center, also known as SAVIC. I've heard here on the telephone line, some people call it SAVIC. We are located on the former King Salmon Air Force Base. We're urging your support in reauthorizing House Bill 141, an act relating to allocations of funding for the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. With the state's taxable wages decline that will result in a TVEP shortfall of $1.32 million, SAVIC will have a decrement of $39,600 for FY18. But as more and more workers get displaced, it's even more important that we provide training or retraining for those in the workplace by training Alaskans for Alaskan jobs. SAVIC provides workforce training for the 31 villages in its service area. This training has a direct impact on the local and Alaska economy. In the state's 2014 wage report for SAVIC, 115 HASWOP trainees contributed over $5 million to the state's economy in the first year after training. This April, SAVIC will have 3 HASWOP refresher courses and 140-hour HASWOP class. These students also, they will continue to add to the local and state economy. At SAVIC, we're working to improve the seafood processing industry's hiring of Alaska and local residents. The state's made gains in resident hire, yet we still battle high non-resident hire. For instance, the Bristol Bay Borough is 93.8% non-resident hire. Dillingham, 84.6%. Lake and Penn Borough, 91.3%. That's over 3,300 jobs leaving Bristol Bay and the state. That's a total of over $29 million that could have stayed in the state and multiplied in the local and state economies. SAVIC provides workforce training through strong partnership funding, including 3% TVEP and local contributions from regional organizations, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, the Bristol Bay Native Association, Bristol Bay Borough, and Bristol Bay Housing Authority. The UAF Bristol Bay Campus and Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, they provide contributions directly for training. Since fall of 2016, that's this training year, 152 students have been trained in 22 classes. We have about 12 more trainings planned this spring. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 141, and thank you to Representative Fansler for sponsoring this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elby. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Elby? Next on the line is Annette Caruso. Do you have anything more to add, Ms. Caruso?
No, I don't, sir.
Okay, thank you. Next on our list is Deanne Hamilton, Personnel Officer with Red Dog Mine. Ms. Hamilton, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Deanne Hamilton, Personnel Officer for Tech Alaska, which is the operator of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska. And I'd like to thank the Chair and the Committee for allowing me to speak today on House Bill 141, reauthorizing the Technical Vocational Education Program. Red Dog employs about 600 people in our busiest time in the summer, and we work very closely with the Alaska Technical Center. We provide input into the development of their process technology program, and we continue to work as a key business partner today. They responded quickly to our request for more soft skill development, very important for us, and they revised their schedule to show students what working long days at a mine would be like. Very important there, too, for them to see a realistic viewpoint of life at a mine. And we also believe that this work helps to improve our retention of employees, and we depend on ATC to support our work here. We recently brought up 11 ATC students here to the mine, building on their training at the center by providing job shadow experience to those students and allowing them to see firsthand the work they could be doing as millwrights once their training's completed. ATC helps students to gain access to high-paying jobs, making connections with industry that would likely not have happened otherwise. Through its process technology and millwright maintenance programs, ATC works very hard to establish skills we need and will continue to need as we look at the future of the mine. TVEP funding is very important for ATC to continue its work, and we do urge you to reauthorize House Bill 141 to provide funding for the Technical Vocational Education Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Any questions from the committee from Ms. Hamilton? Don't see any questions. Thank you for testimony again. We also have Cheryl Edenshaw with the Alaska Technical Center in Kotzebue. Ms. Edenshaw, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Cheryl Edenshaw. I'm the director of the Alaska Technical Center. We're located in Kotzebue, and I'm testifying in favor of reauthorizing the vocational education program. As you probably know, we are recognized by the state of Alaska as a statewide post-secondary training center eligible for TVEP funding. And I'd like to start out by thanking you and the state of Alaska for your support of workforce development and the investment made to the Alaska Technical Center over the years. We have key partnerships with business and industry to train safe and responsible Alaska workers and help develop and sustain our economy. Without the TVEP funds, we would not be in a position to maintain our long-term commitment to meet employers' needs in the local and statewide economy that we fulfilled since our inception in 1981. Without TVEP funding, we would not be able to provide training necessary for jobs and the health care, in the areas of healthcare, resource development, process technology, culinary arts, and construction trades. We would also not be poised to respond to employers' market-driven on-demand training needs in a timely fashion to align with those job opportunities. I urge you to support reauthorization of TVEP, and with the state's help, we can build a future for Alaskans, strengthening our families and communities across the state. Thank you, Representative Fanser, for sponsoring House Bill 141.
And thank you, Ms. Edenshaw. Any questions from the committee? Doesn't look like we have any questions. I do have Karen Sedzo with Partners for Progress and Delta signed up for questions. Ms. Sedzo, do you have any testimony you'd like to provide? Not sounding like it, so we do not have anybody else signed.
Chairman, this is Karen.
There we go.
Delta?
Hi, Karen. Yeah, yes. Do you have any comments you'd like to provide?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Fanslor for introducing this particular bill and the reauthorization of TVEP funding.
And really Ms. Sedzo, for the record, can you provide your name and affiliation, please?
I'm sorry. Karen Sedzo, Partners for Progress in Delta, Program Development and Coordination, Delta Junction, Alaska. Partners for Progress in Delta has been a part of the TVEP Regional Training Center Group since 2008. Partners for Progress in Delta came about as a result of the Department of Defense identifying a lack of skilled workers in Delta Junction when it was making its decision to established the ground-based military installation in Delta Junction. The Department of Defense completed an economic development report identifying this lack of skilled workers
And as a result, the Delta Greeley School District took the lead to bring together educational partners, which ultimately led to a very formal educational consortium. Those partners include the Delta Greeley School District, Alaska Works Partnership, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Community and Technical College, and UAF Cooperative Extension Service, all with a dedicated mission of helping build Alaska's workforce through education and training. We've taken that seriously. The board has been essentially the same since the beginning of its incorporation in 2007, remains committed to this mission, and I can tell you since I interview many of the students every year and have been involved with this organization since the beginning, it is life-changing, especially for the young people in this community. Many would not have opportunities to go on and get real jobs and be able to contribute to a fund that makes it possible for those in need to be assisted. We have young people who are not necessarily going on to college who are wondering what they're going to do with their lives. The augmented career and technical classes at the Delta Greeley High School, the Delta Greeley Career Advancement Center is jointly operated by the Delta Greeley School District and Partnership Progress in Delta. The lack of TVET funding for continuing that facility's operation would have a significant bearing on the quality of career and technical programs offered there. We have high school students taking dual credit courses as required by the last cycle of refunding and education legislation. Those areas include occupational endorsements in welding, certificates in applied business, expanded allied health classes, construction trades, math for the trades, English 111 and others, core requirement classes as appropriate, in addition to a wealth of programs offered through cooperative extension for pesticide certification, agricultural related programs. There are adults in this community who are not able to get to Fairbanks to get a degree, and they're working on it right here in Delta Junction because they have access to the facility. It is an amazing experience to walk into that building and see young people's eyes light up, getting an idea of what might be an option for a career path in their future. And so I am happy to answer any specific questions about what we're doing in Delta. I should add that a very significant component of our programming and our career opening opportunity is the Summer Construction Trades Academy. It's an entry-level Trades Academy in cooperation with the Alaska Operating Engineers and Employees Training Trust, which now considers this particular three-week intensive training program in Delta as an approved training program from which some participants might have direct indenture opportunities. Since the inception of that academy in 2006, we've had more than 125 participants be accepted for opportunities in apprenticeships or construction trades related industry. Our 12th program will be offered this June. It's a three-week intensive program. Students walk away with work ethic, safety skills, as well as certifications in such things as MSHA, OSHA, North Floor Card, forklift training. And many of them have opportunities for work in small communities. We reach out to the interior. We've had participants from North Pole, Delta, Choke, Glen Allen. We've had some from rural villages. We've had folks from Valdez and someone from Juneau participate in this particular program. And it is a very successful working relationship with the operating engineers.
Thank you, Ms. Soto. Any questions from committee members? Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your work with Partners for Progress. We do not have anybody else signed up for public testimony, but we will leave public testimony open. And we are going to set this bill aside until a future meeting, and we will take up House Bill 79 now. So thank you, everyone who is here for House Bill 141. We look forward to hearing it again soon. So House Bill 79 does have a committee substitute, and I think what I'd like to do is get that committee substitute before us as we start to work or continue our work on this bill. So Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt CS
HB 79 version D, Labor and Commerce, as the working document.
Okay, seeing no objections, we're working with version D, and we may actually adapt this version as well. Next step here, we have department, if we can have Ms. Marks come forward and provide some discussion of the summary of changes. And we do have on our desks before us a description of the summary of changes. So if someone doesn't have that, let me know. Looks like everyone's got that. And it looks like we've got Ms. Marks and Ms. Vanajak. So thank you. If you can put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your statement, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair Kudo. If it's okay with you, I would have Ms. Banasek walk through, just kind of give an overview of the changes, and then I'd be happy to talk in more detail about the specifics. For the record, my name is Marie Marks. I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation.
And for the record, I'm Debbie Banasek, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I'm just going to walk through the proposed changes to HB 79 based on this newly adopted CS. I'll go through them pretty quickly, and then Marie Marks, the director, can answer any specific questions you might have. Basically, to begin with, the title of the bill was changed and added to reflect the proposed changes in the bill itself. Under Section 9, there was language that was added that person actively in charge of the operations of a business entity, in quotes, or person that has, quote, the authority to insure the business entity, those persons will be liable for penalties for an employee's failure to insure. And basically, this proposed change would make sure that if a business entity had 11 members with less than 10% ownership interest, that a person is still accountable for uninsured injuries and penalties for failing to insure. Moving on to Section 11, the CS adds language that clarifies the division's civil penalty assessment, that it must be based on substantial evidence, and it clarifies that an employer's civil penalty is based on the amount it would have paid had the business been insured as required by law, including properly classifying its employees. In Section 13, this deals with civil penalty assessment appeal. This isn't a substantial change from the previous bill. It's just making a technical revision clarifying the civil penalty assessment appeals process. The previous language in HB 79 was a bit unclear, and we thought it'd be better to reword it. Section 16 addresses pre-authorization by adding language to clarify that the pre-authorization's request estimated fee is subject to the Alaska medical fee schedule, just like any other workers' compensation medical bill. Section 18 addresses the hearing schedule, and this gives the workers' comp board control of the scheduling of hearings unless a party has a good cause to move a hearing date. Having the parties control the hearing schedule process over time has led to inefficiencies and protracted resolution. Section 19 really just simplifies the self-representation language and makes it clearer than version A. Section 23 addresses the reporting of a change in compensation and adds language that the division will provide notice to an employee when an employer has either terminated or changed compensation. Section 24 clarifies how an employer will be notified that an employer has denied benefits. Section 25 addresses penalties for failure to timely pre-authorize medical care. That penalty is 25% of the amount in the pre-authorization request. Section 27 repeals the section addressing how benefits are paid. It used to be say that you had to pay by check. Now there's so many ways to pay benefits that we just decided that section wasn't needed any longer. Section 28 revises the language to allow the Benefits Guarantee Fund to file a lien within 1 year of the fund's knowledge of an employee's injury or death.
because sometimes the fund might not know right away when the death or injury occurs, and this gives them a year from the time that they have that information to file a lien. Section 30 refines the independent contractor definition. These revisions ensure that true independent contractors can continue to operate as independent contractors.
Yes, question, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, we had a letter from the Alaska Trucking Association with concerns. Obviously, the business there relies heavily on independent contractors. Have you largely addressed, and I haven't gone chapter, line, and verse through your amendments in this substitute, but have you largely addressed the concerns that the Alaska Truckers Association brought forward vis-a-vis the independent contractors that they work with?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, in addition to the truckers, there were some other stakeholder groups, such as the Home Builders Association, that mentioned recurring themes. And so if it's okay with the chair, I could just walk you through the definition and what we have changed to kind of point out how that has been addressed. But in answer to your question, yes, we believe this definition addresses those concerns that have been raised.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Marks. And did you want to run through the definition now or wait until we go through the rest of this?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure it was on the record.
Whatever is the will of the chair and the committee, Representative Tarquito.
Okay, how about if we get through the description and then we can come back and discuss that definition in a little more detail.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on Section 36. This further discusses persons liable for criminal penalties for failure to pay compensation. So basically, it adds similar language to as was discussed in Section 9. Section 37, it talks about persons liable for criminal penalties for transferring assets. So it adds in, again, actively in charge of the operations of a business entity or person that has authority to insure a business entity as persons liable for criminal penalties for knowingly transferring assets with the intent to avoid the payment of compensation. And finally, in Section 39, it's just a simple definition of employee. It deletes the definition of employee where it said in the service of and inserts employed by in the definition of an employee.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Vanizek. I think we are at question time. Maybe before we get to questions, Representative Knopf, we did have the one from Representative Birch. Ms. Marks, if you wanted to go through the definition.
Thank you.
I'm actually good. If it suffices.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, from the department's viewpoint, we believe it does suffice to address those concerns specifically raised by stakeholder groups.
Okay, thank you, Representative Knott. Question for Ms. Marks? Or
yes, if I may.
On the definition?
Yep.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, if you could go through the changes.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the new revision is now Section 30, which begins on page 17, line 7. To address some concerns about whether this narrow application, this narrow definition, applies outside of workers' compensation, we stated that intent was to only apply workers' compensation. It did not apply to IRS or other labor law definitions. But just to make this clear, on line 8, there was added in a sentence that says, for the purpose of this chapter, to address that concern. Another change that was made is down on lines 13, 14, and 15. The concern was raised regarding control and direction if federal, state, or municipal law required that direction and control, or if the contract plans and specifications required that control. And so we make clear that control and direction performed as a result of the requirement of law or the contract would not be impermissible. That is allowed when an independent contractor can still have that control and oversight. And would not negatively impact their determination of whether or not they're an independent contractor.
Could I
Just question?
If she could just provide, through the chair, an example, a hypothetical of what you're speaking of.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, one hypothetical that was raised was if, for example, hard hats are required for health and safety reasons, that the person that the independent contractor is performing services for, the person or business, if they have can make sure that their independent contractor who's working for them wears a hard hat and control that aspect. And so if they don't, the person they're providing services for, can control that. And that will not mean that person, independent contractor, is not an independent contractor for that reason. So that types of things to make sure that safety laws are followed.
Okay, thank you.
The next change that was made is starting on line 16 through 18. And
What page do you want now?
Through the chair.
Of the working draft, we are on page 16. 17 now?
17, through the chair, Representative Knopf, 17 of the working draft, starting on line 16 through 18, correct. The concern was raised that often contractors may provide materials or equipment for use, but that an independent contractor provides all the other tools and labor. And so after hearing from various stakeholder groups, this clarified that an independent contractor is a person who provides tool, labor, and other operational costs necessary, and recognizes now that materials and equipment can be supplied by the contractor to the independent contractor without pushing that person, that independent contractor, out of the definition. Another change is that on lines 23 of page 17, the initial draft had required only a business license, and this clarifies that any license or permit or certification that's required by the work the independent contractor does will suffice to meet this prong. And then overarching this test, we looked at how the 11-factor test, the mandatory test, applied, and based on input from various stakeholder groups, changed it. Instead of having 11-factor, all or nothing, must meet every factor, or you're not an independent contractor, we looked at what some states had done, and had a two-part test. And so instead of 11 or 12 factors that you must meet, now you have 7 factors that you must meet. And then we have some optional factors, criteria. There is 5 criteria that you must meet, 3 of the 5. And I think that allows the net to be wide enough to capture the true independent contractors, but still narrow enough to make sure that employees are not in this definition. And that was a change that we made. And so in H, on page 18, those 5 prongs are optional to the extent that a person meets 3 of those 5 prongs. So it allows a little bit more flexibility.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. March, prior you had 11 that had to all be ticked off, so to say.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, 11, one of the factors was a two-part requirement, so 12, 11 and a half.
And so now you have 7 plus 5, of which you need 3, so it's really down to 10. And are all of these 12, the 7 plus 5, are those the same 12 that were in the original description? There's just a little loosening up of you're down to, say, 10 out of possible 12. Is that a correct assessment?
Correct. Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that's correct.
So we went from 12 to 10 out of 12.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
And I would just like to clarify, Chair Kito, if that's permissible, that the prong that we received, I think, the most feedback that it would create complications was one that we moved to an optional instead of mandatory, and that is our optional H5. a person engages in a trade, occupation, profession, or business that are outside the usual course of business for the individual. That we received a lot of feedback that was a little bit more complicated to apply, so that is why we did move it from a mandatory factor to an optional. So if a person does not meet that factor, as long as they meet three of the other factors, maintain liability insurance, which was in there in the previous version, maintain a business separate business location, that was in the previous version, and then to provide additional flexibility, we added two more very objective ways to verify whether someone is an independent contractor. Do they advertise Craigslist, newspaper, and do they hold a bank account in the name of the business?
Thank you. Any further questions from Ms. Marcus on the definition? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Marcus, I need to apologize for asking you an elementary question, but I need to spend more time with the bill. I assume, and you sort of dealt with this in H1 on lines 7 through 9, if the independent contractor test is met, unless the person is has a solo shop where they're they have some trade that they operate out of their home or something, and they travel to a site. Obviously, if they have employees, they too need to buy workers' comp, right? It's just that they're not getting it from the general contractor. It's sort of my thinking.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. This test, this is used to determine whether a person providing services is an independent contractor. That is a separate inquiry, whether that independent contractor may also have employees. That is true. But this test is a person providing services, for example, for a contractor. We would use this test to determine whether they are, in fact, a true independent contractor.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Marks? Representative Knopp.
So on that note, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that note, you have a lot of home-based businesses, so I'll say mechanics, carpenters, plumbers operate out of their house, garage. So is a home-based business classified as a separate place of business? So example, plumbers don't really do any work there, but they're based there. So how are you, is that a qualification is my question.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, under H2, and this is on page 18, line 10, the business location just has to be separate from the location that they're providing services for. So we look at the contractor business. Are they getting mail at the contractor's business? Do they set up shop in the contractor's business? In this day and age, I think it is very common for people to have merely a website as their base, but it has to be just different from that contractor. So we would look to where that contractor's business is and see if they are there.
Thank you. Follow up.
Well, I have three more questions, and I'm not sure who they're for. Do you want me to go now, or
go ahead and we'll see if we've got the right person.
So I'm curious. I'm going to go back to the drafting of the committee substitute. And so on the very first, when we're amending sections 9 and 11, in everything else we do, we either have it in bold and underlined or bracketed and deleted. And I see nothing to that in sections 8 and 9 where we've added and deleted. So when I'm reading this, trying to compare the differences, that's helpful. I don't see it there. Should it be there?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, because Section 9 and Section 11 have been repealed and reenacted in full, there wouldn't be any bolding and underlining because that indicates change. But through the chair, Representative Knopf, I'd be happy to point out the change in language if you would like.
I can find it. Thank you. I just wanted to clear that. So follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So I have a confidential letter I can't share with you, but it comes from a municipal attorney who had concerns about, I'll just read this section to you. I see no benefit in deviating from the Federal Labor Standards Act guidance and Alaska court jurisprudence regarding the distinction between employees and independent contractors. Keeping in mind, he has not seen the committee substitute yet, so I'll get that to him. But subsection 11 of section 31 of the bill deviates substantially from existing status quo and adds unreasonable additional requirements defining someone as an independent contractor. that exceeds federal guidance in prior decisions by our Alaska Supreme Court. So my question for you is, after reading that, did our the proposed fixes alleviate them concerns, or would you suspect that we modified it enough to, are we substantially more restrictive than what the federal guidance is in that?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, when you refer to federal guidance, I just want to clarify, are you talking about federal IRS standards? Because there's not a federal workers' compensation body of law.
Federal labor standards, FLSA, so I would expect that's what he's referring to, that's what he referenced. So
through the chair, Representative Knopf, this is a very narrow application, and it does not apply to all labor standards. It applies to workers' compensation. Okay. And what states have found, and especially since 2007, I'd say over the last 10 years, is that these multi-factor balancing tests are not working. They're not working in states to tackle the issue of misclassification. And the IRS, for example, has a 20-factor balancing test. And that may be fine for IRS purposes, but for workers' compensation, where the goal is to protect workers from severe injury and death and protect employers from huge uninsured losses, the multi-factor balancing tests are not working. I have employers contact us, the Division of Workers' Compensation, and say, are my employees independent contractors or not? They want to be proactive, and we want to be proactive. And we give them a balancing test where no one factor is determinative. It is very difficult for these employers, especially small business employers, to know whether they meet that test without going to an attorney and perhaps getting some legal advice. Our goal is to make this a clear test, a much clearer test, so employers know ahead of time what the requirements are, and employees or independent contractors can know and protect themselves what the requirements are. So it is different. It is different. It was intended to be a change.
Okay, thank you. And then my last question, Mr. Chairman, is for you, actually. So your staff sent us out a summary of letters of opposition and letters of support, and in the letters of support, there was components that were supported and components that were not supported. So I guess my question would be, now that we have the committee substitute, if we come out with new letters of support or opposition, and it's not supported in its entirety, could we break out them areas of concern for committee members? So,
Representative Knopf, I do think what we will do is weigh the issues of concern and then definitely determine whether or not there's some things in there that we need to look at closer as a committee, or that we move forward and believe we don't need to look at, or believe it's appropriate for a future committee to cover some of those areas, and we can have that discussion definitely. We're not moving this bill today. We'll have another hearing on it, and we will also be available to open up public testimony in the future as well. Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Marks, when you were talking about a multi-factored test, it sort of sounded like I'm imagining sort of a continuum of behavior or sort of the acts undertaken by an employee, whereas here you're just laying out very clear statements. Is that what you mean? In other words, in the prior system that you said didn't work, there would be narratives such as, is the person that works for you doing this, or is it more like this? That sort of, and they were trying to, the employer was trying to sort out whether they had been misclassified.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you're correct that the current test is set out in regulation and defines employee. And states have deal with this different ways. Some define employee, and they may define that broader. Some states instead define independent contractor and define that narrowly. Mm-hmm. I think what states have found is that defining employee has led to complications and misclassification. I mean, really, and I'm going to be, misclassification is an issue that's being dealt with all throughout the United States. And those tests of employee are more difficult to apply. And so there is states that we looked at that, instead of defining employee, decided to take the route to define what is an independent contractor. And that's much clearer application. And so you're right, it would be a switch from defining what an employee is to here defining what an independent contractor is. And then the definition of an employee is revised to state an employee is someone who is not an independent contractor that has a contract for hire.
Any further questions for Ms. Marks? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So another constituent who is a real estate broker, and all of his realtors are independent contractors. And so I guess my question is, does this apply to that type of organization? And so the question he asked me earlier is, would he be subject to having to pay minimum wage? Because they're all work commission. So does he have to pay minimum wage and then the FICA and the workman's comp and everything that an employer would do? He's wondering how far ranging this really is, other than the workman's comp issue. So,
through the chair, Representative Knopp, I believe that it would be safe. I think it would be safe, and this is why: is that real estate licensed persons who perform services for real estate have an exemption. They are one of the 10 groups. And again, we don't exempt groups, but individuals who meet the requirements are exempted under the Act. And so under 233230, subsection 10, a person who's a qualified real estate licensee who performs meets the requirements is just the Workers' Compensation Act does not apply to them.
Thank you. Any further questions? So we've got some more work to do on this bill, and we've only brought the CS before the committee. And so what we're going to do is hold the bill over. We'll have opportunity to take a look at it, and there are a few other things I think we're going to look at trying to update. And it is a fairly expansive bill, so I'm not anticipating that we'll be moving it along extremely quickly, but we will be trying to make sure that we make good progress on it. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. I think I know the answer once again, but I just like to say it. So I'm here from your words. But so what you said was defining an employee is tricky. Basically, there's two types of people in this world: employees and independent contractors. And trying to define employee got complicated. So you're going to define what an employee isn't, which is an independent contractor. I mean, you're basically putting into two categories, and the independent contractor was more easily defined. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, first part of your question is there two types of people, independent contractor and employee? There's more than that. You could be a volunteer. You could be a trespasser, but for all intents and purposes, correct. Someone is an independent contractor or an employee. In answer to the second part of your question, since 2007, states have found that these multi-factor tests, primarily to define employee, are not working and have led to misclassification and difficulty of employers, honestly, employers to know what the test is that they need to meet. So correct, in line with what many states are doing, it is defining an independent contractor instead of employee.
So follow up. So what an employee isn't, basically.
An employee would be someone who is not an independent contractor but also has a contract for hire, correct, that differentiates them from a volunteer or a trespasser.
Or a babysitter.
And babysitters, I believe, through the chair, are exempted as well.
and through the chair, I mean, the term contract for hire, I'm sure there are exceptions for lawn mowing 12-year-olds down the street, but those kind of contracts are contracts for hire. Even they can be, even though there's nothing written down. I'm sure I could create all sorts of work for you.
Through the chair,
if I started to look into this.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act applies to employers, and employers are those that conduct business. So, for example, as a homeowner, if you have someone come to your house to complete a plumbing project, mm-hmm. unless you do business out of your house, you are not an employer. So you would not, that person would not fall under the Alaska Workers'
right.
Compensation Act.
Right. Mr. Follow-up. Really, it's a housekeeping measure or request. This bill strikes me as, all bills are important. This one seems particularly important. And if we could have, like, 48 hours notice of the chair's intent to move the bill, that would be really useful.
Certainly. So we do have some other work that needs to be done. We will be bringing the bill before us again And I think we'll have a conversation before that. We won't bring it forward and move it out without some conversation. We need to make sure that the additional changes are going to be, I guess we'll determine whether or not they're substantive and not substantive. I think we'll make it a little bit easier for us to work on it, but there will be plenty of notice on the bill.
Thank you.
Anyone else? So we will go ahead and hold House Bill 79. For continued work, and if you've got any thoughts, comments, suggestions, definitely work with the Department of Labor and my office, and we can. We're still in the mode of looking at the bill and seeing what we can do to make it better, and kind of having those conversations. So feel free to work with us and with the department to make sure that happens. So we also, I think before we go, I want to recognize that we've got our LIO moderator, Summers Cole, and our recording secretary, Caitlin Ellis. Thank you both for being here today and your patience. And without anything else coming before the committee today, we will be back here on Wednesday, and we've got a full meeting Wednesday, and at 4:41, we will adjourn House Labor and Commerce for March 6, 2017. Thank you.